percentage problem. Maybe it's only 0.01% of the vehicles. But 0.01% of 8 million vehicles is, what, 800 vehicles? Something like that. But it's a large number of vehicles. And every one of those people...
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Every one of those people are being put at considerable risk. Looks like I timed out the machine. Oh, well. So, if you guys like, I'll give you the website. You can read them yourselves and come to your own conclusion. And I think you and your friends should read these. Anybody against me doing that? KQRIW.
Comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Leslie.
Well, this would actually... I found that you are very sensitive about human life and the issue of safety. And it's what I do not like is when I hear that something was closed that was helping people to get their right to be properly listened to what they have to say. And that scenario actually takes place in every possible situation. Starting from September 11, it takes the place when we're talking about free energy. When you hear that somebody just eat something unhealthy and he died, and then this number of people, they did that, but they happen to be inventors or whatever. Or you hear that the companies they were trying to just fight for the human safety were closed. So this is the sensitive part of me. Back to you, Dr. Jeff.
Okay, I hear you. The first report you should read is entitled Toyota Sticking Pedals Recall is a Smokescreen. And that was written by Mr. Erling Keith Armstrong, a electromagnetic compatibility expert, running a company that does those kind of researches in the United Kingdom, and he was specifically hired by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to do that work. Extremely good report. I recommend you read it. One of the easiest ways you can find it is to go to this website, www.nutwooduk. I'll spell that out. N-U-T. W-O-O-D-U-K .co.uk/downloads, plural, /Toyota.doc. So it's November Uniform Tango Whiskey Oscar, Delta, Uniform, Kilo, Dot, Charlie, Oscar, Dot, Uniform, Kilo, /download.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
You talked too long. Yeah, sorry about that. /downloads. /Toyota dot doc. So I will say that one once more. NUTWOODUK .co.uk /downloads, plural, /Toyota .doc. Beautiful document. Let me drop. The next document is from an extremely good organization called Safety Research and Strategies Incorporated in Massachusetts. And they've done a whole lot of research. And when you look at their report, is a little bit on the long side. It's about 50 pages, but you just look at the synopsis graphs on page 6 through 8, and you look at the conclusions on page 50, and I think you're going to say, wow. Okay, the email address for that one, let me drop it and I'll give it to you. This is what I call document number two. Again, both of, all of these documents begin with www.safetyresearch.net/library/toyota-sua-02-05-10-final.pdf. So that organization is safetyresearch.net and /library/Toyota with no punctuation in between is SUA, which we and I know stands for sudden unexpected acceleration. And that number 020510 is the date, February 5th, 2010. final.pdf. That document is another beauty. And there's a supplement to that one since February 5th. Let me drop. The February 17th supplement to that one, the addendum, even makes the points a little bit stronger. www.safetyresearch.net/library/report_addendum.pdf. The underscore addendum is addendum.pdf. What you'll find in that one is that a whole lot of these reports, let me drop,
K2IO.
Bernie, I'm going to repeat these, so don't worry. A whole lot of these reports, a whole lot of these investigations were terminated because of a lack of evidence. My goodness. Well, they were terminated because of a fatality. And in the addendum report, what you're going to find out is that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is a regulatory agency which is trying to regulate the safety of automobiles manufactured or imported into the United States. A person who was working on the safety of those automobiles, in NHTSA, a person who worked for Office of Defects Investigation, ODI, a person working for that office doing these investigations, now works for Toyota as an assistant manager of technical and regulatory affairs. And some of that changeover of policies occurred at the same time that person was changing positions. Bernie, you had a question. You want to repeat on one of those? Go ahead, Bernie, K2YO, K2LAW.
I was just going to comment. I believe that the second document, I think the document name is case sensitive. I typed it in, did not get through to it, although I was able to find in their menu system to find the document. I had all the letters correct, but the official title has uppercase and lowercase, and I think it is case sensitive.
Very fine. Okay, so I'll repeat document number two. www.safetyresearch.net/library with capital L for library /Toyota with capital T for Toyota followed by Sierra Uniform Alpha, all capitalized, followed by 020510 followed by final, F-I-N-A-L, all capitalized, .pdf. PDF is lowercase. So is that the way you found it, Bernie? Go ahead.
Yes, affirmative. If anybody's having trouble on the right-hand side of the document not found page, there's a red set of menus for Toyota, sudden unattended acceleration, and that will take you to the same link to pick the February 5th document.
By the way, Bernie, were you familiar with these documents before I brought them to the net attention tonight? Go ahead.
I'm negative. I just looked them up as you were giving them out.
And Bernie, were you able to find both the first, second, and maybe the third document already? That's good news. Were you able to find all three so far? Go ahead.
I got the one from the Nutwood, UK. I got the one from February 5th. I don't know what you mean by the third one. I do see that there is a another one from the safetyresearch.net. So I'm assuming that's the one you're speaking of, the February 17th.
That's correct. The so-called addendum, which I think is February 17th. That one is www.safetyresearch.net/library, capital L for library, /report, lowercase report in this case, _ addendum, all lowercase, .pdf. That's the one that talks about the change of personnel between those two organizations, and it talks about the number of reports that are being dropped because of insufficient evidence. And it talks about, I forget what was the third thing that alarmed me, but to me that was alarming information. But the compendium of all of these reports is that there are thousands and thousands of cases that are randomly happening. That so-called second report, when you look at page 8, 9, and 10, and you look at those graphs for how many years, how many vehicles, how many kinds of vehicles, and how much denial apparently is going on, it's going to alarm you. At least it alarmed me. And so we need information in this case. Let me drop. The greatest piece of information we need is what you do when it happens. And that is, you're going to put the car in neutral first. You're going to put both feet on the brake, and you're not going to pump the brake, because that uses up the vacuum reservoir. And with a wide open throttle, you don't have any vacuum left to fill up the reservoir again. That's the defense. And the next thing you want to know about is which vehicles are being recalled, what repair is being done to them, and is the gas pedal repair, both the change in the so-called stickiness of the gas pedal and the possible entrapment of the gas pedal, is that enough? These rather authoritative reports with a whole lot of data to them will probably lead you into saying, no, that is not enough. There's a lot more going on. We'll be discussing this in future weeks, guaranteed, because the 8 million vehicles, I think, is now climbing toward 9 million vehicles. This is an all-time record. I mean, before this, the biggest recall I know about, let me drop, was the 250,000 vehicles of Audi in the middle 80s, again from a runaway, what appeared to be a runaway accelerator, but it wasn't the accelerator doing it. And there's a significant amount of evidence here that it's not the accelerator doing it. There's more going on. Okay. Anybody with any further questions, comments, or requirement of a fill, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the deck net.
YLP.
Go ahead, Bob. And I hope you don't know anybody with one of these affected vehicles. WQILP, K2LIW.
K2RIWW2IMP. Come to think about it, I may have had an accident due to that problem, but I can't completely confirm it. I was going to talk more about surge protection in aircraft, where you have a lot of problems because of static buildup, and in the worst case, direct lightning strikes to antennas. And I have taken apart black boxes, even antenna couplers, where you opened them up and there was nothing but carbon inside, completely disintegrated. I've seen coax cable going from VHF transmitters where he sent the wire, sent the conductor, was completely burnt open. But I don't want to spend time on that. I just want to tell you, I have a 2002 Camry that was involved in a minor accident that now, come to think of it, it may be because the accelerator, even after I took my foot.
Glad you did, because you timed the machine out.
Well, the accident that I was going to tell you with a 2002 Toyota Camry, which is not one of the ones listed for recall, happened when I was
driving up to the Northport VA, where they have a guards there that you're supposed to show your ID picture card in order to pass. And I reached in my pocket to get my picture card, which unfortunately I hadn't taken out in advance. And in doing so, I hit the accelerator. But the car still lurched forward enough to hit a car that was waiting to get checked in. And it was, I hit him hard enough for him to hit the car in front of him. So both of them sued my insurance company. Of course, the guards were there as witnesses. And so the accident was my fault. There was only minor damage to my car, less than $500 worth. The bumpers on the Toyota plastic, you just touch them and they fade in. So I just chalked it up. But now thinking about it, it may be that the accelerator did not stop accelerating fast enough for when I applied the brake for me to stop in time to avoid hitting the car ahead of me. And I won't hold it much longer because it is getting late. But I do thank you, Dick, for talking about these things, and I will visit those websites. Back to you, W2IO.
You are currently connected to Reflector 9126.
Gotta wait for the beep. Roger, Dodger. Thank you for resetting. I got good news. I got news for you, Bob. When you read these reports, particularly the second report, you'll find out it has been happening to Toyota Camry since 1999. There's been a whole lot of reports, and the Camry is the one that's been happening to the most, starting in 1999. Even though that's not on the recall list, they're heavily involved from 1999 going forward. And with any further questions or comments, or Phil, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Into AGN.
You got it, Alex. I mean, Wesley.
Well, next to my houses that I have on Andrews Avenue, in Muscat, there is a guy who I know for years, who actually buys the cars, he repairs them after the accident, and he resells them. That's what I've got. When I spoke to him after you mentioned a few times about the Toyota, Toyota is the most oftenly purchased car by him. And he say that the amount of damage to this Toyota is so great that I'm able to buy these cars for pennies, fairly new cars. Of course, he is absolutely master in being able to get these cars to the proper shapes. And he uses the Chinese pieces of whatever. I have no words. But the thing is that when he, or parts, when he compared this part, the Chinese parts, to the parts being used by Toyota, there is no big difference. It is no big difference. And he says, the most of American cars made in America, they are much better than any of Toyota's that he was working with. And he was working for 20 years with different kind of Toyotas. So he said, it's the worst of the cars ever. And to Exia.
Yeah, everything I'm reading and hearing tells me that this problem is not going to go away anywhere near as fast as everyone would like it to. The problem is nowhere near as simple as you would think. These new reports are now showing that the new lead-free solder and the unreliability of a printed circuit board using lead-free solder is quite possibly a strong contributing factor. Lead-free solder is known to create tin whiskers that create phony short circuits. It also creates low-strength joints that crystallize and go into a powder. And the problem is particularly bad with ball grid array microprocessors on a printed circuit board. Let me drop. Right now, there are a significant number of military programs for the Department of Defense where the contract now says that when you fulfill the contract to build this piece of electronics for the Department of Defense, you will not use lead-free solder. It is unreliable. There's a significant number of military contracts that say that, and from what I'm beginning to hear, it maybe is the majority of military contracts. So I think we, the people who think they're green and think they're getting rid of lead in the environment, there was a lot of lead in the environment in our fuels a decade ago. Let me drop. But when it comes to eliminating the lead from the solder that's in the copper pipes in our house and on the printed circuit boards of our computers and whatever, I think they really went overboard on that one. The rate at which the lead leaches out of lead solder is extremely slow, unless you put it into acid. So that lead leaching into the environment sounds great. Did anyone ever do any research on that? The lead that's in the environment, if it came from the fuels that used to be leaded, I believe it. If you think it's leading, if it's leaching out of this extremely stable compound called lead-tin solder, I'm becoming very skeptical of that. I can take apart the pipes in my house that are 50 years old, and I can inspect the joint and look for the inner portion of the joint and see, has any of the solder eroded? And the answer is no. The solder that was put there 50 years ago is still there. I'm talking about the inner surface where the water touches it. You think you're making the water in your house safer by using lead-free solder? I doubt it. The lead-free solders require very exotic fluxes in order to properly work, and that's probably a hell of a lot more dangerous than the original lead that was in the solder. So there's a lot more to the story. Okay, I think we've kept everyone up late enough tonight. This one, again, was SickNet number 1,285 of the series that began in September of 1982. Try to be kind to each other. Tell all your friends.
Hey, Dick, one last thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Okay. How much sodium is safe for you to take in?
My research tells me, and there's a little controversy on this one, as I research it deeper and deeper, as long as you're not a person that's doing a whole lot of sweating and losing the sodium through the outer portions of your skin, as long as you're living a normal life, the minimum sodium requirement appears to be 200 to 500 milligrams per day. 200 to 500 is what I'm finding in my research. And the crazy recommendation for the United States is less than 2,500. I think it's much too big a number. Eight very serious symptoms in my body essentially all disappeared when I went down to, I probably averaged 400 a day. And you'd be amazed how many things contain it. Is that the number you're looking for, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point that, you know, your body requires a certain amount of arsenic to function properly. And even though you can look at your pipes for 50 years, and I'm sure you've heard the stories, you don't drink the hot water in your house because it actually, if you were to actually take the water and measure the amount of lead that is in the water, there is, even though you don't see any erosion, we're talking about, you know, molecules worth. So it's like anything with the human body. When you're talking about biology, most of the things that we go by is if you don't need it, you don't need it. You shouldn't have it. But, you know, the FDA and other organizations say there is a safe level. So my point is, what's the safe level? If you can eliminate the lead from your ingesting it, that would be a good thing, yes?
I agree. But even for the hot water pipe, if you did research on the way pipes are normally put together, the majority of that joint, the sweated lead, is in between the inner surface and the outer surface of that socket, you know, the right angle adapter and things like that. The actual amount of solder that's truly exposed to the water is an extremely small amount.
Yeah, it is, but all it takes is an extremely small amount for a person with sensitivity to be affected. So, you know, you may be talking about micrograms here. For example, there's a substance that's called LSD, and the typical dosage of that is 10 micrograms, which is not much.
When it comes to lead in our water and what you think is an acceptable amount, are you giving that performance in parts per billion? Back to you, Eric.
There actually is a number in parts per billion in terms of how much lead there is, because when you think about not necessarily the water distribution system, because a lot of that stuff is steel pipe, clay pipe that's brazed, but when you go through a water system, it's not a single joint of lead. There's many joints, depending upon where you are, if you're in an apartment building, blah, 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 so on and so forth. The point is, really, the concept of not having lead in your drinking water is really a good idea, no matter how little it is.
Okay. Do you believe that we're coming out ahead with the grief that is created by lead-free solder when it comes to electronics? Was that the right move from what you know?
Well, actually, the world is all about recycling. You can recycle lead. It's so easy to recycle. It's easy to separate from stuff. But, you know, if you really want to get picky, how about the beryllium oxide we throw into the ground? I mean, isn't that a little more dangerous?
What I think he was talking about how strong is the solder that contains lead compared to the one that does not.
Oh, you're right, Wesley. That's certainly a big part of it. Nowadays, there was a short period of time in which everybody was throwing out their computers and monitors, and they were ending up in the waste dump, and that in turn, people thought all of those toxic chemicals were leaching into the environment and eventually getting into the water table. Nowadays, I believe every responsible citizen is disposing of their computer and their monitor in a toxic waste center, and therefore they're being recycled in theory. But if you watch 60 Minutes, you find out that they're really being shipped to some second world nation, and that's where they're being disassembled at the risk of that particular population, depending on what kind of a procedure they're using for recovering the materials. Let me drop. So, when it comes to eliminating creating lead-free solder for our chunks of electronics, and considering the way that we now are supposed to be disposing of used electronics, I'm not convinced that we've come out ahead with lead-free solder. With all of the whisker damage that I'm hearing about and all the grief that it's creating, I think we've lost more than we've gained on this one. Over to you, Eric, KQIW.
Yeah, I agree with you. If we were still in the days of using terminal strips to hook things up and, you know, nice big vanilla connectors, it wouldn't be an issue. But because you need a damn microscope to see what you're working on these days, and the spacing is so tiny, just a little bit of a tin whisker is enough to kill a $100,000 piece of gear. I know, because I deal with $100,000 pieces of gear that get killed. It's painful. But, you know, that's more likely what you're looking for these days than a bad component. But, you know, it's all about human responsibility and what you do and how you manage to handle things. I mean, our biggest problem with groundwater these ways is MBTE getting into water and pharmaceuticals. I mean, how's that? Because, like, in the city of New York's water supply, they're finding pharmaceuticals they never thought they would ever find in the water, and in reasonable quantities, too. It's a bad thing. They don't talk about it much, but it's there.
Don't worry, guys, we're approaching the time when we have a Chinese electronic in America, when you have a Chinese Toyota, where when you look at the original parts of Toyota, they manufactured it in China, some of them. at least. And then we're talking about the situation which nothing that is American is American. I'm sorry. This is my personal opinion. I have a right for it. The First Amendment and to extreme.
I hear you, Wesley. Eric, have you done soldering with lead-free solder? Do you like it? Would you like to continue using it? Over to you, Eric.
I'll tell you a little secret. I keep two rolls of solder. One is 60-40 good old lead tin solder, and then I have some silver solder, which is silver and tin. The lead roll gets emptied much faster than the tin roll does. And actually, the surface mount stuff that I had, I got 60-40 solder paste that I used. I also have lead-free solder paste. It's something, you know, they say you can't mix this stuff, but I mix it all the time. But there are some things with where you need the lower temperature, and the unleaded solder is a little bit helpful in those conditions. But I use it rarely, but I do use it.
Into RDB comment.
And to RDB recognized. But first, Eric, I assume that the lead-free solders require higher temperatures and more exotic fluxes. Are they a lower temperature? They used to be low-temperature solders, but I didn't think they were lead-free. What kind of temperature is required for lead for 60-40 solder? What kind of temperature is required for 60-40? What kind of temperature is required for lead-free? Over to you, Eric.
Depends upon the mixture that you get. There's a couple of different mixes. I mean, typically 60-40 solder you can consider to be, what is it, 600, let's talk Fahrenheit or centigrade. Because all my gear is in centigrade, so it's, I think, around 650 or 640, something like that. And the particular paste that I use for the surface mount stuff is around 5 something. It's gonna be about 294 degrees centigrade Celsius for that stuff. But the fluxes that I use, actually, I like the flux because all flux that I use these days is water soluble. So when you're working on a board, you just, you know, finish soldering it. You run it under hot water and it comes out nice and clean.
Are there particular lead-free solders that are known to be better or worse with reference to tin whiskers or brittleness of joints? Go ahead.
Yes.
I have a paper that I keep on the wall that tells me which solders are the ones that are good and which ones are the low temperatures and which ones are the high temperatures. It depends upon the size of the pad and the type of board that you're working on. You want to try and stick with, you know, the recommended mixtures. It's simply because if you use the small pads with the higher temperature stuff, the pads usually curl up. Or if you're using, 2 ounce, if you're working on 2 ounce boards, you can use the high temperature stuff. If you're working on 1 ounce boards, you better use the low temperature stuff. And that also depends upon what size components you're working with.
A2YL.
Bernie, recognize you're right in for Tim. Go ahead, Tim. N2RDB, K2RAW, my name is Dick.
Yes, I'm definitely a fan of the net. I've checked in a few times before, but lead-free solder? Well, I work with the stuff on a daily basis. And I work with the leaded stuff. And the lead-free stuff, well, quite frankly, it sucks. I solder these little surface mount chip caps into place using it. And because you have to be 50 to 100 degrees higher in soldering iron temperature, flux is the same, by the way, but it causes the little silver electrodes on the chip caps to peel away. So I don't know about any tin whisker migration, but you know, the fact that it causes problems with chip caps and you get cold joints, and it's just harder to work with, personally. N2RDB.
Do you work with AR6 surface mount size parts?
Why don't you repeat that question, Eric?
Yeah, I'm wondering if he works with 806 or smaller size surface mount components.
Jim, that question was for you.
The size of the component varies, but generally toward the smaller end of things. I have found that the smaller you can make the lens on the substrate that you're soldering to, the less heat you require, the less solder you require, therefore less chance of things going wrong. Due to the frequency ranges of the filters we make, the components themselves vary greatly in size.
Yeah, well, what size is it? 806s, 402s, 1206s? Because it kind of makes a big difference.
Yes, it makes a great difference. The larger components are definitely more of a pain to work with. And as I said, it depends on the fundamental frequency of the filter and 2 RDB. I work with 806s, 1206s, everything.
Okay, because if you've never seen tin whisker problems, then you're probably not having really closely spaced. You work on 402s, you'll see it happen. But then again, you're probably in the manufacturing end. You don't really get the parts back. Or, you know, you're working on sub-assemblies that get thrown out.
Eric, from your experience, how long does it take for the tin whisker to grow? Is it aggravated by temperature, humidity, or whatever? Over to you, Eric.
Well, some of the stuff that I work on, it's really electrical properties that cause the problem. And it's also the physical spacing of the pads, too. The kind of pads that I work on sometimes, on some of the cameras that we have, they're all 402s and smaller. I mean, some of them are even lens that is deposited, and then they deposit the resistors on the board rather than actually physically mounting them. So, low current stuff, you don't see the problem very often. Stuff that's got a little bit of current going through it, you'll see it more often. But, a lot of the cameras that, when they're manufactured, they usually run for 3-4 years before you run into a problem, and then you start to see it happen. It doesn't happen that often, but it happens. When it happens, it's just a big pain in the you-know-where, because, you're working on a $100,000 camera, and in these days, you don't want to spend a lot of money, so, you know, a typical board swap is like, you know, $8,000 to $10,000. They don't want to do that. They want you to fix it.
Cameras are they?
Yeah, what kind of cameras is Wesley's question. Also, I think you said you've worked with 402s. Do you ever work with 0201s? And any of that work, I know you'd have more enjoyment if you had a real stereo zoom microscope. Over to you, Eric.
Don't get me started with that. you were going to buy me one. Actually, I've been lucky not having to work with anything 02 size. It's always been a little bit bigger. But the kind of cameras we're talking about are broadcast cameras. They're kind of expensive. Actually, the lenses are more expensive than the cameras sometimes. But that's just one set of deals. But it occurs on a somewhat regular basis. I mean, you know, Sony and Panasonic, they put out bulletins about it, and because it's... there'll be a particular circuit that's kind of prone to it, and they really recommend that you lift those components off the board, clean them off, reflux the whole thing, wash it, and then put a layer of paste down and, you know, blast it with hot air and reseat the component. And it also depends upon how the board was manufactured, because some of the automation systems actually put a little dot of glue on the component, and then put the component, align the component, put it down, and then they basically put it in the oven, because that's how they heat up the whole board, just to the point where the solder, the paste melts, and you get your end result.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm not that modern one, but I remember... for the past 50 years, the best that was used along with the solder, it was the California. the California is being used in violin, and is the material that you possess from the trees. Now, question is, any kind of other medium that is being gathered, is that as good as California, or we just simply, guys, forget about it? And to explain.
I think that question is for you, Eric, but I'm not sure I understood the question.
Try again, Wesley, but one thing I will say, California pretty much has the most stringent ecological requirements, but compared to Japan, Japan is even more difficult than California is, so. But try it again so we understand what you're saying.
Okay, about risk.
There's another station.
It's W2ILT. I think you're referring to resin, which is used on violin bows, and it's also used in flux. Go.
That is correct. In Europe, it's being called California, not California, California. And to exhale.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you just run by that last one quickly? The one with the reported denim loose? I'm missing a letter or two apparently.
Roger. The addendum report, I call it report number 3, www.safetyresearch.net. And by the way, if you just go safetyresearch.net, you're going to see a whole lot of reports if you start scanning just Toyota, sudden, undesired acceleration, SUA. So it is safetyresearch.net/Toyota- Oh, wait a minute. This is the wrong one. Sorry about this. Let me go back again. safetyresearch.net/library, with capital L on library, /report, all lowercase, _addendum, all lowercase, .pdf. QSO?
Try it again. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, that report number 3, the addendum, which is the February 17th, 2010, that is a mind blower. If you understand what it is saying, it's going to alarm you, in my opinion.
Scary stuff all around. Okay, let's get back. Thank you very much, Ned. To FLF.
I was going to say one more thing before I go. K2KUY.
You got it, Mel. Wait for the beep.
I talked recently to one of the companies, amateur radio company, sell a product, amateur radio, and they quote ridiculous prices on fixing ham equipment, you know, up-to-date stuff, the stuff that lasts a couple of years. And in speaking to one of the hams there, he says they've gotten to the point now where they're not doing components anymore, repairs down to the component basis on the board. They're just replace the board, Dick. This is what it's coming down to. No more point-to-point troubleshooting, over.
In a way, I can sort of understand that. It gets, assuming they've got the spare boards ready to roll, it gets the most amount of repair done in the least amount of time. You're just replacing the whole darn module, the PC board, and all the components on it. That's the good news. The bad news is that you and I are going to pay more for that. We amateurs tend to get down to the individual component level, trace out the board, find the bad tantalum capacitor, and replace it. We don't have a spare board. We're not willing to order one and wait for it to arrive. In some cases, an awful lot of the electronics I own, the board would be obsolete. I wouldn't be able to buy it. So lucky for me, I've got a microscope. I do a lot of surface mount component repairs all the way down to the 0402 level. I don't think I've done any 0201. Those are the ones that look like a very fine grain of sand. You got to go to higher magnification on the microscope. Let me drop. So we amateurs are still going to be doing those repairs, as I see it. I think to some degree, manufacturers have been doing board replacement instead of component replacement for a lot of time. I'm not so convinced that that's recent. But if you're saying that that philosophy is increasing. I can see that, and I believe it. I can see where it's coming from. I'm going to have to leave you guys. More of this to follow. I'm not sure we've settled any of these issues, but at least we're slowly becoming a little bit smarter on all of those. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, why don't you put some closing ribbons on it? K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2YL.
Bernie recognized. After Mel signs out, we're going to go back to you, Bernie. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Say goodnight to all. And, as far as salvaging, I salvaged a radio that was only a little over a year old, Dick, that was going in a garbage pail. And this was not a cheap, not a high end, but it was a considerable a radio, I'd say conservatively around, between around $1,000. And it was going in a garbage pail because of the price that they quoted to repair this radio. So I was given it, and it's a challenge to fix them, no doubt. And then on top of it all, when you get in touch with the company after I finally trace down the problem, which happened very easily just by, I think possibly just reversing the battery supply, the amount of damage was unbelievable. And if I traced it down, I called the manufacturer, and they don't handle the parts, believe it or not, because they're not doing this troubleshooting at the component level. So I had my hands full calling up DigiKey, Moser, and a couple others until I ran down the individual components. This is what you're facing today, so not the world. I guess I can leave the 250-watt soldering iron in the drawer. I don't think we're going to get much use of it in the near future, except to put coax connectors on. 73 golf. Talk to you next week. Take care, everyone. K2KEY going QRT. Got to get the bed.
Thank you, Mel. See you next week. And good thing you're tough, and good thing we're crafty, and we know how to repair things. Bernie, K2YO, go right ahead.
I was just looking for a quick comment on the soldering discussion about water-soluble resin or water-soluble quartz. It's been many years since I worked in a lab, but when I did, we loved the water-soluble stuff, just because you could stick it under hot water and scrub the boards up. But recently I was building a kit by a ham-based company, and they specifically said, do not use water-soluble solder. And I thought that was rather interesting. Any comments from you guys about pros or cons of using the water-soluble plus?
I can give you a couple words on that. By the way, Dick, go to 60 Minutes, CBS.com. Tonight on 60 Minutes, you can see the whole piece. It's the guy who invented the fuel cell for the Mars rover actually started a company called Bloomberg Power. You'll find the whole thing very interesting. It's a fuel cell that actually will function with very impure stuff. It's an interesting piece. You should check it out. Some of the problems with the older water-soluble flux is that they were slightly acid. Today's water-soluble fluxes don't have that problem, Bernie.
Gotcha. Okay, I was just curious. I had never heard that comment before, and never really knew why, and the people that made the comment didn't have any real data they could back it up with. They just didn't want to do it.
I saw the piece on Bluebird Power, and the very first customer was Google. Looks like he's got an awful good product there. However, he also claimed that if you pour electricity into it, you get the oxygen back out on Mars. Well, the raw ingredients required to do that, I think, are either water or carbon dioxide. If you haven't got enough water or carbon dioxide on Mars, I'm not sure you can do enough of the reverse process. Over to you, Eric.
No, you get water and hydrogen. It's the same thing as a PEM fuel cell, except there's no PEM. There's no platinum. You don't need the catalyst. His fuel cell is ceramic and silicon. So he obviously came up with a way to do, I'm actually going to try and look up the patents and see how it goes about it. But, you know, it's the same as a traditional fuel cell, except that it's going to be a lot less expensive. A traditional fuel cell, like the town of Babylon had Plug Power. They had their fuel cells there. It only ran for about 2 years. The bad thing about it is his thing will use any kind of biofuel or natural gas, and anything that's carbon-based is going to make carbon dioxide that you're going to put back into the air. That's the only negative aspect of it.
Now, most of these fuel cells take the equivalent of oxygen, put it together, you get electricity, and you get water as a byproduct. He also claimed he's got this green stuff he puts on one side and the black stuff he puts on the other side. It looks like paint. And that's his magic sauce. And maybe he hasn't patented that. Maybe he's holding that close to his chest. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, all we have to do is look up... do you get NASA tank briefs?
Yes, I do.
Okay, you know, they have a large database, and any of their inventions that are done by NASA are all published, so, you know, the clues are going to be there. You just have to go to the database and take a look.
Sounds good. And he's got some very impressive customers. It does sound like he's got something, and they've been in use already for a year and a half. A couple of glitches in the beginning, but I begin to think he's got something. What do you think?
Now, if he's more than got something, I mean, don't forget, your traditional fuel cells need if you're going to work with water and split it up into hydrogen and oxygen, it's got to be deionized, which is expensive to start with, and the amount of energy that it takes to make it is a ridiculous amount. The concept that you can use any kind of dirty old stuff in this is just amazing. Even the Plug Power natural gas fuel cells, they had to have scrubbers on them before you could feed in, otherwise the cell will die, the cell will clog up. They use a polyethylene film that is soaked in Nafion, and the Nafion is the molecular barrier between the hydrogen and oxygen side. If you feed water into it, you get hydrogen and oxygen. If you put electricity into it, or if you feed hydrogen and oxygen into it, you wind up getting electricity out of it. The fuel cells work both ways.
A completely reversible process. If this unit from this guy, Green Power, I can't think of his name right now, if it can take a dirty fuel, what stops the dirt from building up on those plates?
Now that's what his secret is. That's what I want to try and get a clue about. Obviously, he's doing it at some kind of a coarse level, whereas, the PEM membrane clogs up very easily. He's doing something that's not a PEM membrane. He's doing the hole transfer somehow or other in the material, in the ceramic material. So, I don't know. I could just barely guess at it. I want to try and investigate it a little more because I'd like to get my hands on one of those things. That would be really cool because, I mean, a typical fuel cell is something like 6 to 8% efficient. His things are supposed to be 30% efficient.
Boy, that sounds awful good. And maybe it's got some kind of a reverse flow periodically cleaning cycle, which cleans out its plates. What do you think?
You know, in 60 Minutes, they showed his thing. And if you look at how deep the channels are in between the blocks, I don't know. It's really coarse. I mean, if you've ever looked in, I've made PEM membrane fuel cells just for... You know, there's a place on the web that's called the fuel cell store, and you can buy all the components that you want to make your own fuel cells. You ought to try doing that one day just to look at the process. I kind of got interested in it when a company came out with a replacement battery for a broadcast camera that uses these little cylinders of hydrogen, and it's actually using the camera, it drips water down their back.
I guess on a hot summer day that could be kind of nice, but in the wintertime you might not like that, particularly if you're... if you're taking a picture of an Arctic environment. Oh, well. Fun stuff. I've got to go. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW.
You got the K2 job. K2IO, K2J.
K2IO.
All right, I'm going to play it in a second, but don't forget, you'll only hear it on 8.5. You won't hear it on Echolink.
Fine, I listen on 8.5. I just keep the Echolink running because it tends to get bounced off, and just because of the service, there's a couple of guys that that listen through Echolink, so I just leave it running so I can connect them back up again.
The time is 1 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
I guess that means nobody on the tech deck can hear me. Can't fix that. Test 1-2, just checking to see if my radio's working. Anybody on the reflector here? KF6WPQ.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1697 with a release date of Friday, February 19th, 2010. To follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The ARRL commits to helping change Rules 97.113 so more hams can take part in disaster drills. Meanwhile, the FCC issues a giant waiver to Part 97.113 covering 32 licensed ham employees in Georgia. A California ham solves a broadcast remote pickup jamming problem, and rare earth is growing a lot rarer. Find out details on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1697, coming your way right now. From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is Jim Davis, W2JKD. The ARRL appears poised to ask the FCC to liberalize Section 97.113 of the Amateur Radio Service Rules. This to give hams more leeway in taking part in emergency training drills sponsored by their employer. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, has been following events in this ongoing saga and has the latest.
With the arrival of February's QST comes confirmation that the American Radio Relay League is indeed preparing to formally join the call for change to Section 97.113. Dave Sumner, K1ZZ, confirmed the issue has been a hot topic ever since the release of a report from an ARRL board ad hoc committee regarding the whole issue of pecuniary interest and amateur radio. Given how much attention the issue has gotten at the FCC, the result of petitions filed requesting changes in the rule, the ARRL is now ready to act. In his editorial in the February QST, Sumner referred to the ARRL's board motion instructing ARRL staff to, quote, urge the FCC to add an exception, 97.113 of the FCC rules, to permit an amateur station, licensee, or control operator, on behalf of an employer, to participate in emergency preparedness and disaster drills that include amateur operations for the purpose of emergency response, disaster relief, or the testing and maintenance of equipment used for that purpose, unquote. Sumner concedes in his editorial that there are a wide range of views from among ARRL's membership ranks, with some suggesting there be no change at all in the rule, to others saying the rule is just too limiting. Sumner says, quote, given that the FCC appears to be inclined to consider changes, it behooves the ARRL as the representative of the broadest constituency of radio amateurs to formulate an approach that addresses the bulk of the concerns about the present rules with as little impact as possible on the volunteer character of amateur radio, unquote. As we told you a few weeks ago when we reported on a petition on the matter filed by Rich Moseson, W2VUFCQ magazine,